supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And Gottlieb, thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Drug rehabilitation centers, what most people know about rehabs, come from this.
Actress Lindsay Lohan is reportedly back in rehab. Her rep says she checked herself into the Southern California facility on Monday, just days after being arrested for driving under the influence.
Well, Don, we know that Britney Spears has checked herself back into rehab. It happened today, and it happened on the urging of her family, including her mother. She is in an inpatient facility in Los Angeles.
If anyone knows about Hollywood rehab, it's Danny Bonaducci, who's been in at least three times.
Their success rate is approximately 8%. Do the math on that. Their failure rate is approximately 92%.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no.
So, is Danny Bonaducci right? He did the math, and I must say, he got it right. 8 and 92 make 100. Is he right? Only 8% success. What really happens in rehabs? Do they work? Do they work at all? And how do they work? There's lots of questions we have about rehabs. We've got a panel of experts who hopefully will answer all of them. I'll start with Edward Deal. He's chairperson of the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. He's also president of Seabrook House here in New Jersey, and he's also recovering for the last 33 years. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be here.
I'm also joined by Rick Pine, president and CEO of Live and Grin in Ben Salem in Bucks County. Rick, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And Diane Warmer, she's program manager for residential services at Live and Grin, more of a hands-on position, yes?
Yes.
Welcome to the show. If you want to join our conversations about rehabs, what works, what doesn't, if you've had experience in them or working in them, give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Ed, let's start with you. Let's tell us about the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. What are they? What do they do?
Well, NAATP, the acronym, is a trade association, essentially, representing treatment organizations, both nonprofit and for-profit, throughout the country, as well as we're represented in Canada and Mexico. And our purpose is really to advocate for families who struggle with addiction, both in the area of public policy, health insurance, trying to speak with professional expertise, our physicians most pointedly, to dispel some of the misconceptions about what addiction is and how people get well.
So you're working on stigma there, among other things.
Absolutely.
What about, I'm interested in content here, as a listener might be struggling with substance abuse or a loved one. There's lots of research coming out. Is part of your organization's responsibility to share research, new treatment research, with other organizations, or do they share with one another?
Oh, yes, we do. We are at the table at all times with federally supported research initiatives like the National Institute of Drug Abuse, the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, which is part of HHS in Washington. And what we really try to do is encourage our members to participate with universities throughout the world to continue to struggle to learn more about effective medications, effective approaches through psychotherapy in order to improve the outcome of people seeking recovery.
I'm curious, if I'm a substance abuser or a loved one is, should I be looking for a for-profit or a non-profit Or doesn't that matter?
Well, similar to hospitals, Dan, throughout the country, some are for-profit and some are non-profit. The majority of our members happen to be not-for-profit organizations, which is true of most health and human services organizations. There's certainly... I wouldn't make a judgment that a for-profit is better or not as good as a not-for-profit. We're all pretty much about the same in terms of treatment content.
Rick, let me turn to you from Live and Grin. What do you have to do before you can open your doors as a drug treatment facility?
Well, in the state of Pennsylvania, if we're going to advertise our services or promote our services for alcohol and drug addiction, we must be licensed by the state of Pennsylvania Department of Health, Division of Licensing, as a substance abuse facility. Well, and there are stringent guidelines and operational procedures we have to follow in order to be able to receive that licensure.
Like what? What do you have to do? What do you have to... staff patient ratio, level of training, tell.
All of that. Our clinical staff must all be certified, and many of them are also licensed. There are strict staff patient ratios that have to be adhered to, and in a residential facility, that's around the clock. There are required trainings that all of our credentialed staff have to attend on an ongoing basis, not just initially. And the facilities must meet life safety code regulations. They must provide for the safe and well care of our patients. And as well, all of our programs are reviewed. Our documentation is reviewed on an annual basis.
So as I'm listening to what you're saying, these kinds of criteria sound pretty stringent and pretty narrow. And they could cover a wide range of programs, anywhere from locked doors to a country club. Any philosophy from no drinking to the goal being able to social drink. Those guidelines can cover them all.
They could. And in Pennsylvania... our licensure, we're not only covered by state licensure, but around the country, we're also covered by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, which also monitors and analyzes what we do for our patients. And that's not just for us, but in the Joint Commission covers Ed's program in New Jersey, as well as all the other 50 states.
I want to get into content a bit. Most... I think it's fair to say most rehab programs are based on a 12-step model, or certainly incorporated pretty heavily. First, who wants to take a crack? Maybe Diane, tell us about what a 12-step model is.
A 12-step model is what many people would know as the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous. And it's a program of, you know, you have to take a look at what your addiction is causing in your life and the necessary changes you need to make in order to live healthy and be a productive member of your family and of society.
And it follows 12 really well laid out steps.
Oh, absolutely.
Acknowledging that you're out of control. It's a faith-based program. It's about being able to give up your control to a higher power.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a spiritual-based program. I think there's a separation between what is traditionally known as faith-based programs and the spirituality of the 12-step philosophy.
Yeah, my mistake.
My opinion, that is.
Yeah. So let me turn back to you, Ed. How do we know that works, or do we?
Well, what we do know is that Alcoholics Anonymous is the most successful program for interrupting the progressive pattern of addiction in anyone addicted throughout the world. The statistics certainly bear out that moving into an abstinence-based lifestyle and then adhering to a self-care regimen, which is really the 12 steps, whether it be for alcohol or drugs other than alcohol or sex or gambling, all of the compulsive disorders that we treat in our facilities throughout the country today really are geared toward recovery, not just the intervention of treatment, but long-term recovery. And our association, the National Association, is really doing a great deal more of late to emphasize that treatment is an episode and that recovery is an outcome that our people who we attempt to serve strive to achieve.
I want to come back to the 12-step issue. You mentioned research, but because of the nature of 12-step programs, you don't see any controlled studies. You don't get any data about how it compares to other programs. I wonder where the faith comes from in the program. Ed?
Well, in fact, there have been a great many studies that, in combination with other therapies, the abstinence-based model certainly unequivocally has been accepted scientifically as the way to go. There was a RAND study back around 25 years ago that was horrific, that suggested that a percentage of the addicted could return to social drinking and drug usage if they went through a period of behavior modification. And the ultimate outcome of that research is that a terrifically high percentage of those people ultimately died of their addiction. So we go with what works best for most. But addiction certainly is a chronic illness. It has a very high relapse rate. But we in America today, I mean, we look for the quick fix. We look for the absolute solution by any medical or psychological intervention. But we wouldn't say to a person with chronic depression that, here, take this pill and you'll never be depressed again. Folks who are on antidepressants hopefully deal through psychotherapy and their own self-care with that chronic illness lifelong. The same is true with the addicted.
I want to challenge something there, and I hope I can capture my thought. I love the parallel you drew about relapse, and you know, you're right, we don't beat anybody up with any other chronic illness other than substance abuse, and you know, next to pedophiles, substance abusers are still the pariahs in our country. On the other hand, when people with depression relapse, we don't suggest that there's something they're doing wrong or something they need to do better. And that's one of my concerns about rehab and about this model, that if you slip, then there's something you need to work harder on. There's something you're not doing right that you could or should have done right. And that concerns me. Rick, do you have a...
Well, I think what Ed said a moment ago about what works best for most, and that is an abstinence-based program. Without falling into cliches, it is a simple program, but it's not an easy program. The simplicity of it is don't think, don't drink or use, and go to meetings. How much more simple could it be? But how to get there? Any addict, any alcoholic can put down the drink or the drug. They've done it 100 times. The key is how do they live their life more simply, more fully, more comfortably without that drink or drug. And that's where the ongoing program of recovery comes in. That's where that balanced lifestyle is required. And that's where the support and help from 12-step groups come in. Will there be slips? There will be people who will relapse, there will be people who need help again. And that's why I'm distressed by hearing about the celebrities who failed or have to be readmitted, and people will look at that as a failure of the system. Without getting into any individual's case, we know from those of us in treatment that probably half or more of the people who come to us the first time are going to need to come back or some other program. It's part of the progression of the illness.
Yeah, years ago I read a study, and I don't recall whether it was nicotine addiction or some other form of addiction, but the study showed that every time you fail and try again, your prognosis improves, your chances of getting clean.
Well, just look at what the American Cancer Society has taught us about quitting smoking. They years ago began to say that the majority of people who ultimately stop smoking, which now is a majority in America, are people who continue to try. And if you continue to try, the statistics are extremely high that you ultimately will quit. I can speak from that from a firsthand experience. And that is why, I mean, Dan, when we go back to whatever it was, about 5 years ago, Robert Downey Jr. was in the news at least every 25 days as this judge didn't know what else to do, sent him to rehab and then to jail and then to jail and then to rehab. Now, God bless that guy. That's what we say who have compassion for those who suffer from this illness, because it's my understanding that he's clean and sober today. So are 6 interventions enough? Are 10 interventions enough? If it's my son or my spouse or my loved one, there's no number of interventions that are enough. I have depression in my family. Someone very dear to me has struggled with this for years and is doing exceptionally well for the last 10 years. But it was a long, hard road, and families can't give up on the addicted just because their behavior, a symptom of their disease, is aberrant behavior. And that's where the stigma, I think, comes from.
We're talking about rehab facilities, what works, what doesn't, why doesn't it work, what are the different philosophies. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Sandy on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
I am a substance abuse treatment researcher, and I called in earlier to talk to you briefly about AA and research, and there's so many things you've talked about since I want to touch on. But substance abuse treatment research does show that AA works, although we can't actually do AA-based evaluations because of the nature of confidentiality with AA. We can do substance abuse treatment outcome research and factor in whether or not AA participation was a factor and whether it was statistically significant, and it most certainly is a statistically significant factor in positive substance abuse treatment outcomes. But more to the fact, I wanted to address the relapsing that you talked about a moment ago, how so many people do relapse in substance abuse treatment, and a lot of it has to do with the first step of AA and recognizing one's powerlessness over their addiction. And it's a very difficult concept for people in our society to recognize that I'm powerless over this and I don't have any control. And that's part of the social stigma that goes along with it, that people often view addicts as being weak or having a character defect and being unable to stop when other people are able to stop. And the relapsing often comes from that unwillingness to accept that they're powerless and to think that I can control it now, I can control it now, and to ultimately get to the point where they can recognize that they can't. And to point out, and then I'll get off the phone, that $7 are saved for every treatment dollar spent for individuals. And that is talking about incarceration rates, criminal justice system, medical health care system, social service system, unemployment system. $7 are saved for every treatment dollar spent. So if our society went towards a more treatment-oriented response to substance abuse as opposed to a penalty-oriented response, we would go much further in our world.
Well, Sandy, you know, under ordinary circumstances, I would thank you for calling in and sharing all your rich data, except now we've got nothing else to talk about. Yeah, we've covered everything.
We have another chair here for Sandy.
We'll find something. Thanks so much for your call, Sandy, your insights, and thanks for the work you do. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in 60 seconds to cover some more aspects of rehab, what works, what doesn't, how to find facilities that are going to work for you or your loved ones, and of course, we'll take your calls. My guests are Ed Deal. He's chairperson of the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. He's also president of Seabrook House. Rick Pine is president and CEO of Livingren, here in Ben Salem in Bucks County, and Diane Warmer is a program manager for residential services at Livingren. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Right. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at our healthcare system and discuss the problems and possible solutions with John Oberlander, Associate Professor of Social Medicine and Health Policy and Administration at the University of North Carolina. And we get his critique of Michael Moore's new film, Sicko. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about drug and alcohol rehab centers, what works, what doesn't. How do we find what works for us or our loved ones? My guests are Rick Pine, who's president and CEO of Living Green. Diane Warmer works at that program as a program manager for residential services, and Ed Deal, who's chairperson of the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. I went to visit one of these celebrity rehabs in Arizona several years ago, and the facilities were beautiful. The people in the facilities were like the people in any other facilities, only had deeper pockets, I imagine. It was based very much on a 12-step model, very much on a 12-step model. The staff was young, and they were trained very well in the 12-step model. And that was the tool they had to treat people. So that they were using a model to treat rather than treating people who we know, substance abusers are complex. We talk about dual diagnosis. I've never met one substance abuser that didn't have a dual diagnosis. So that was one of my concerns. So how can a family member protect themselves from going into a program that's pretty monochromatic? Anybody want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, Ed? I'll take that. What we encourage people to do is to, and I've certainly encouraged my own family members, close and distant, when looking for professional help in the behavioral health and addictions area throughout, is to really investigate the evaluation process, the diagnostic process up front. Simply going to the most colorful Yellow Page ad is not any way to shop for a treatment center for an addicted person. Certainly at our facility in New Jersey, we treat co-occurring disorders. We don't believe that the problem is simply alcohol or drugs, and that is singularly what needs to be addressed. The comprehensive embrace of the patient is what is more the standard and the norm today than years ago.
Diane, you're on the line there. If I want a loved one to come in to your facility, what question should I ask you?
What size are the groups? You know, what are you providing for the monies that we're going to pay or that the insurance is going to pay? You know, what does a typical treatment day look like?
Stop there.
Sure.
What does a typical treatment day look like?
Our patients are up at 6:30 in the morning and have their shower and hygiene, etc. They have breakfast. They're in their first meeting at 8:15 in the morning. A community meeting where we discuss the various topics of the day, if there are any changes in schedules. You know, sometimes we do outdoor activities. If the weather's bad, we have to make a change there. They go into their first group therapy session at 10:30 in the morning, which is an hour and a half. Then they have lunch. They're back into another lecture at 1 o'clock. from about 1 to 1:45. 2:30, they're back in another focus group. We have multiple tracks at Living Green.
Tell me about the staff that you supervise. What's their background training?
We have a wonderful staff at Living Green. Our clinical staff is, they're just terrific. We have from licensed master's degree level clinicians down to and including our staff techs and certified addictions counselors. In the state of Pennsylvania, we also have a credential CCDP, which is for the dual diagnosis.
What does that mean, those labels? What do techs do? What do addiction counselors do?
Staff techs are pretty much the front line. They help with admissions. They're the first contact, oftentimes, outside of the admissions area that a new patient would have with the clinical staff.
Do they do counseling?
No, they provide support. They really are supportive staff. The next level would be an associate counselor. We have a training program at Living Green where counselors who don't have the state-required credentials yet can be part of this program. They're assigned to work one-on-one with a counselor for very direct supervision for the first 3 months.
You worry about burnout?
Yes. That is something that we do worry about at Living Green and address very aggressively with the staff. We have
a lot of the people who work with substance abusers are recovering themselves, and that's good news and bad news, I imagine.
Yes, it can very much be, and that's why we have clinical supervision groups every week for our clinicians, as well as an administrative group to discuss the issues that we need to address ongoing as well. And we do a clinical journal club that we started recently, where each of our clinical staff bring in a journal from a legitimate source to talk about the newest, the latest, and the greatest. You know, what's the new and upcoming treatment? What are the statistics saying? What are the recent research to help us all grow and stay firm in what we're doing?
We're going to go to the phones, but I want to prepare you for a tough question I'm going to ask later. What's the difference between a good counselor and a not-so-good counselor, and what's the difference between good counseling and not such good counseling? These are critical questions that a parent or loved one is going to want to know, and it's an unreasonable question. So I'll give you some time.
Okay.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Larry on the line.
Yes. Hi, Dan. Thanks for this topic. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
My question is not so much about a specific facilities, but I work in healthcare, and I work in a dual diagnosis facility in the city. And my issue or my concern as a healthcare provider is just the level of frustration that we see because of the recidivism, which you touched on before, and the causes of the recidivism. For example, and I'm in an acute care facility, so we have patients who are. Who we stabilize, and then we send them to facilities like Living Green and others. And it just seems like the societal pressures seem to enter into it to a degree that we can't really, arrest those kind of problems in the facility because we send them out and these things happen. I'm wondering if you could comment on that, and it just leads to a great amount of frustration because, we're on first name basis with many patients. We see them so often.
So the choice almost is to not care so much, which also leads to burnout, or
exactly.
To somehow try to protect yourself, or maybe there's some other answers. Rick,
that's a great question, Larry. I met a counselor once a lot of years ago who said that the way he deals with that knowledge that a certain percentage of his folks aren't going to get it is just the comfort that he has in knowing that at least what he has given them has made their future drinking or drug use more uncomfortable and maybe setting them up for coming back again. I think most of our counselors, and I'm sure the folks where you work, recognize the fact coming in the door that not everyone's going to make it. And as long as we're not filled with that fantasy, and the reality is that some of our folks are going to need treatment again, and some of our folks may never make it, that we can approach it with a more realistic and honest outlook that way.
And I'm starting to see colleagues who pretty much have determined that on a great number of patients will not recover, but their level of sobriety or amount of times in between hospitalization grows and grows, and they try to get some reward out of that, which I guess you have to take your successes where you can.
You know, Larry, I said I made a comment on a show we did on doctor-patient relationships, and my thought was that burnout comes when we try to do something we can't do, and it really is about expectations. And what you can do is provide good service. What you can do is care about the people you're working with. And what you can do is hope. And pray if you do. I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your work. It is a difficult and complicated issue, this business of burnout. You know, my first supervisor, when I first got in the field, he said to me, Dan, I think there are hundreds of alcoholisms. There's not an alcoholism. There's hundreds of kinds, depending on the brain, depending on the background, depending on the family. And I've come to view it almost with the people I've treated over the years, that it's almost like a cancer, that some cancers become chronic and maintained over a lifetime. Some of them are actually cured, and some of them, sadly, are terminal. You battle with it for a long time, and they're terminal, and you just don't know which you're facing when they first come in and meet you at your desk, Diane. You never know. All you know is that it's some form of this terrible disease. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Joe on the line.
Hello.
Joe, hi. You're on the air.
Thanks, Dan.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I'm in recovery for 29 years, and I went to a rehab up in Northeast Philadelphia that was really no frills at all. I just wanted to say this in terms of what maybe is the significant thing in any kind of treatment facility. But this place was very no frills, and it was run sometimes like a boot camp, not completely. We were given a lot of lectures and information about alcoholism, about addiction in general, so we got a lot of good information. And when I came out, one of the very important things it did for me was it gave me 28 days off the streets. And like Larry had said, a lot of times they see people come back and forth because they, you know, get clean or whatever for a short period of time, and then go back into a world that the only world they know, which is very much fraught with addiction and using. And for me, I got 28 days off the street, and I was encouraged from the day one to go to AA when I came out, or go to whatever, you know, 12-step program I needed.
What about the boot camp model, or the near boot camp model? Was that helpful for you?
It was, because my mind at that time was always looking for a way around things, you know? Like, if there was a way to sort of get a person to like me so that I could get out of certain duties or whatever, I oftentimes would go that route, but a lot of times that was really tied into my addiction and getting my way. And so the boot camp model made very clear that I wasn't going to get my way, and in the end, I didn't really want to get my way.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Of course not. Well, Joe, thanks for your call. I wish you the best, and I'm happy you started off in that boot camp model.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Here's the troubling question, though, that comes out of that phone call. The boot camp model worked well for him, and we know that model would destroy other people.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know if you're shopping for a rehab what your loved one, what you or your loved ones need, knowing that most rehabs are going to say, we can help you. They're not going to say, your personality won't fit with us. Go to the one down the street. How do we sort that out? Or
well,
can we?
One of the things that I think is critical, and we certainly, when people call our treatment center, we invite them to come and visit. Admission, you know, you walk through an emergency room in hospitals when you're gravely ill. Sadly, too many people who are looking for a therapist in the community because they have marriage problems, they go to the Yellow Pages. I mean, and we advertise in the Yellow Pages as well, but it's really not the way to go about it. It's to get the right feel. It's to look at the competency of the treatment team. You know, how deep is, you know, you talk about burnout, how well-staffed is an organization? The reference that Joe made to a boot camp model, I would venture to say that typically an older-type program like that that's very tough and disciplined and probably very underfunded. And so you get burned-out counselors when you have too few of them. That's one factor. And it's really important to look at the diversity of the competency of staff and to grill the treatment center, because if you're going to put a loved one in the hands of caregivers, it's our job as the rest of the family to advocate as you would if your old mother arrived unconscious in an emergency mm-hmm. room.
Grill. Who wants to weigh in on how to grill a treatment center?
Again, I think it's a matter of asking whatever questions come into your mind, no matter how silly or frivolous or whatever you may think they may be. As someone who receives some of those phone calls at times from family members looking to get someone into treatment, I will answer anything they have to ask. I think it's very important. If I was looking to get someone into treatment, I would want to ask the tough questions. How many staff do you have? What are their competencies? What are their training? You know, physically, what does the place look like? I mean, they're important questions as well, I believe. How many people to a room?
If it's somebody I love, I want to know how well you're going to take care of that person.
Absolutely.
And knowing that if I've got a loved one I'm sending there, there is an outside chance I'm going to be an enabler and mm-hmm. codependent mm-hmm. and overly focused, and mm-hmm. I'm going to want to make sure you're taking good care of this person, and I want you to assure me they're not going to suffer.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you've heard that.
Absolutely. It's very, very important. I would also go into educating the person on the phone, the loved one, about family programs, our family services, Al-Anon, where they can go to get some assistance for themselves, to have an opportunity to build a support network for themselves. It's very important. Very important.
We've got to take a break, a short break. We're going to come back. Our lines are lit up. And I also want to learn more about what the range of treatment services there are in facilities and how to find them. We're talking about rehabs, what works, what doesn't, how to find the right ones for ourselves or our loved ones. My guests are Edward Deal, who's a chairperson of the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. He's also president of Seabrook House in New Jersey. Rick Pine is president and CEO of Livengren in Bensalem. And Diane Warmer is program manager for that same program. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Hello, everyone.
Recognize that voice?
I'm an exorcist. No, I'm a limo driver. No, I'm an undertaker. Yes, an escapee from an asylum clad in pajamas and a top hat.
Plus, he's Brian Unger.
All right, simmer down.
And he brings you his own twisted take on the news every Monday.
Oh, okay.
The Unger Report next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about rehab centers. Where are they? What works? What to look for to make sure they're the right ones for our loved ones? My guests are Rick Pine. He's president and CEO of Livingren in Bensalem. Diane Warmer is the program manager at that program. And Ed Deal, he's chairperson of the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers and president of Seabrook House in New Jersey. Let's get right back to the phones. We've got Deborah on the line.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb.
Hi.
I'm sorry that you didn't get someone with an opposing point of view on your show as far as these this 12-step approach goes. Unfortunately, I think this country has been 12-stepped, and it's I sent you a website to look at where it has abundant information on how the 12 steps are not any more effective than any other treatment program, and in fact can do harm. And it has become a billion-dollar industry that's based on some non-logical reasoning. And I won't go into more. I just hope you'll look at my website and the website I sent you. It's not my website. And perhaps at some point have someone on with an opposing view to that for your listeners.
Let me ask you this. What kind of treatment works that you're aware of? What kind of treatment would you advocate?
Well, according to the studies that they show on the site, there was a huge study called the MATCH study, and there were others, and I'm not a scientist, but again, you can look at the site, where they say they've compared the 12-step with, like, cognitive behavioral therapy, and in fact, with no treatment at all, and all three come out with the same percentages.
So what would you do if you had a substance abuse problem or a loved one did? Would you?
I can tell you in all honesty and with experience that I would avoid, like the plague, any kind of 12-step based treatment.
I understand. What would you do, though?
I think perhaps cognitive behavioral therapy would be the way to go, one-on-one, not dragged into this entire industry that has grown up around this.
Okay. All right, well, you said you wanted someone with an opposing point of view, then you have become that person. I thank you. Thanks for calling. Aside from a potential debate about whether 12-step is valuable or not, it does address my question before the break about what is the range of programs that one can find for themselves or loved ones. Let me start with you, Ed.
Well, throughout our membership of the National Association, we represent a very wide variety of approaches to addiction. And many of our members not only treat addiction to chemicals, alcohol, and mood-changing, mind-altering drugs, but also might be licensed as psychiatric facilities, may embrace all of the addictive disorders. There is a very diverse range. And just to comment briefly on the last caller's comparison to cognitive behavioral therapy versus 12-step approach, if you visited Seabrook House tomorrow, you would see a full dose of cognitive behavioral therapy in conjunction with reality therapy and approaches as long as your arm. We incorporate what we pride ourselves in is that we are up on the latest research, and the best national research bears out that the abstinence-based approach, where people self-care over the long term, fully achieve recovery in an abstinence-based model, whatever that is.
Is there treatment available for someone who doesn't believe in the 12-step?
Yes.
Where would they go and what would they find?
Well, there are programs now that are Christian-based throughout the country. Some of them are our members as well, where a lot of the therapy is individualized along with group therapy, but they embrace this need, which is an AA tenet, for a higher power to help relieve them of this illness in conjunction with recognizing the physical and the psychological. But their slant is more toward Christianity and returning to a faith-based approach.
I want to talk about something that hasn't been mentioned here, and that's this whole business of the neurobiology of addiction. And I know 12-step programs don't get to that. There's a tremendous amount of research out now on the physiology. New medications are coming out to block the effects of drugs, and a very new one to diminish the impact of compulsive behavior and obsessive thinking. Let me turn to you, Rick. What's your take?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm not a scientist, but when you talk about the research today, almost all of it is confirming the fact that addiction is a brain disease, that willpower has nothing to do with it, as was mentioned earlier, and that it's not simply a matter of somebody just putting down and making the decision not to pick up. There are different things that happen in the brains of alcoholics and drug addicts, and the research today is bearing that out. People need all of the tools that they can gather in order to affect a lifelong recovery. So whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy as part of a Seabrook or a Livengren, or whether it's in your psychiatrist's office, that's all well and good. But if it was a family member of mine, I would want that person surrounded with as much support, as much experience with recovery as possible, and that's what you get in the 12-step rooms.
I recall many years ago when I did this full-time, there was a study done about which type of therapy was the most effective, and what they found was that the greater volume of therapy was the most effective.
That,
you know,
that's right.
Throw
that's
it all at them, you know, and that's what
one
the
of
issue
the
is. I wonder, say what you need to say, and then I want to come back to that impossible question.
Oh, thanks. I was trying to skirt that.
Forget about it.
One of the things that I believe is that I know our staff, and I know Seabrook House, I know people who have worked there. My staff is very eclectic. They have a tremendous amount of tricks in their bag, for lack of a better word. I mean, a lot of education on the various different treatment modalities, cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing. Yes, we're 12-step oriented, but there's much more to the treatment process than just that. I mean, the whole goal is to get people to gain insight into what they need to change to live healthy, and then to encourage them to utilize the 12-step programs after they've left Livengren to have that solid, sober support network in place.
What about the issue of outpatient? Is that the outpatient you recommend, or do you recommend something in addition to that?
In addition, absolutely. The 12-step program, we do not consider that an outpatient program. That is a self-help program. The outpatient program is a must. You know, you go through the various various treatment experiences, and our belief is the longer a person is engaged in a treatment process, not necessarily just rehab or out, but process, the greater chance they have at maintaining sobriety and staying healthy.
So it's about commitment to the process.
Yes.
Well, I guess everything is at every level. I interned at Eagleville 40 years ago. What would I see different if I went to one of your programs today, Rick?
Well, I think the biggest difference you would see is in the staff. Livengren 40 years ago, and by the way, we opened 41 years ago, and we were still caring and committed to what we did then, but the level of training and education of the staff. 41 years ago, it was just Recovering Alcoholics Helping Others. And today we have that, but we also have physicians and nurses and highly skilled, licensed folks.
Different therapies, more therapies.
As Diane mentioned, there's a full range of therapies that are now in use.
All right, I'm going to turn to you, Ed. What will I see when I visit a facility 40 years from now?
40 years from now, I think you'll still see the treatment of addiction 40 years from now, first of all. I think what you will see is you'll see a much better understanding of who becomes addicted early on. Rick referenced this brain disease idea. Our medical director speaks throughout the country on this subject, and it's fascinating how the biology of an addicted person is different from the non-addictive person. So you may see so much earlier interventions that it might even be in utero 40 years from now.
So there'll be much more biological treatment. We might not even need rehabs 40 years from now.
Well, there will be more medications. Mm-hmm. Pharmacology will be different. It would be nice if we didn't need rehabs.
Well, Bill Wilson, co-founder of AA, back in the late 30s, wrote in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous that alcoholism is a symptom of underlying problems. I think we are a culture that needs help lifelong.
Yes, we sure are. We could spend a couple more hours on this. We've got a whole bank of phone calls that we didn't let in, but we are out of time. I thank all three of you for joining us. My guests have been Edward Deal, Rick Pine, Diane Warmer, Deal's chairperson of the National Association of Addiction Treatment Providers. Pine is president and CEO of Livengren, and Ben Salem Warmer is the program manager for residential services at Livengren. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Next week, we're going to have a special show based on a couple of columns I've written recently about four words that I believe could change the world. And those four words are, tell me your story. And that's what we're going to do next week. We're going to have a whole show devoted to having you tell us your story. What does it mean to be you? What are some of the incidents in your life that make you you? We'll look forward to your phone calls next week. Well, the engineer for today's show has been John Knapp. Shane Ewing is our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices from the Family is produced by soon-to-be-wed Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day-to-day is